The following Dharma talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone, to those of you at home. This is a passage from The Unborn, the life and teachings of Zen Master Bankei, Norman Waddell's translation. And it's where Bankei explains his understanding of the unborn, which we hear a lot. What I teach everyone in these talks of mine is the unborn Buddha mind of illimitative wisdom, nothing else. Everyone is endowed with this Buddha mind, only they don't know it. My reason for coming and speaking to you like this is to make it known to you. Well then, what does it mean you're endowed with the Buddha mind? Each of you now present decided to come here from your home in the desire to hear what I have to say. Now, if a dog barked beyond the temple walls while you're listening to me, you'd hear it. And you know it was a dog barking. If a crow called, you'd hear it, and you'd know it was a crow. You'd hear an adult's voice as an adult's voice. You'd hear a child's as a child's. You didn't come here in order to hear a dog bark, a crow call, or any of the other sounds which might come from outside the temple during my talk. Yet, while you're here, you hear those sounds. Your eyes see and distinguish reds and whites and other colors, and your nose can tell good smells from bad smells. You could have no way of knowing beforehand of any of the sights, sounds, or smells you might encounter at this meeting. Yet you're able to, nevertheless, to recognize these unforeseen sights and sounds as you encounter them without premeditation. That's because you're seeing and hearing in the unborn. That you do see and hear and smell in this way without giving rise to the thought that you will is proof that this inherent Buddha mind is unborn and possessed of a wonderful illuminative wisdom. The unborn manifests itself in the thought, I want to see, I want to hear, not being born. When a dog howls, even if 10 million people said in chorus that it was a crow crying, I doubt you'd be convinced. It's highly unlikely there would be any way that could delude you into believing what they said. That's owing to the marvelous awareness and unbornness of your Buddha mind. The reason I say it's unborn that you see and hear in this way is because the mind doesn't give birth to any thought or inclination to see or hear. Therefore, it is unborn. Being unborn, it's also undying. It's not possible for what is not born to perish. We never came into being, and we never go out of being. All of these comings and goings are just pulses in the pattern. I love that. This sense in which I say that all people have an unborn mind, each and every Buddha and Bodhisattva in the universe and everyone in this world of humans as well, has been endowed with it. Being ignorant of the fact that you have a Buddha mind, you live in illusion. Just stop and look back to the origin of this self of yours. When you were born, your parents didn't give you any happy, evil, or bitter thoughts. There was only your Buddha mind. Afterwards, your intelligence appeared, if that's what it is. You saw and heard other people saying and doing bad things, and you learned them and made them yours. By the time you reached adulthood, deep-set habits formed in this way of your own manufacture and emerged. Originally, thoughts have no real substance, so if they're reflected, just let them be reflected. If they arise, just let them arise. If they stop, just let them stop. As long as you're not attaching to these reflected traces, delusions won't be produced. And enlightened awareness is within each one of us right at this moment. This enlightened awareness is truly unborn and marvelously illuminating, and everything is perfectly managed by it. Perfectly. When you're walking along naturally, you're walking in the harmony of the unborn. The nature of human beings has changed very little through the centuries, despite numerous efforts to change it. Nor does it seem likely to be less full of passion, jealousy, and hate in the next 1,000 years, here or in outer space. Conclusively, realize that what is unborn and illuminating is truly awakened and without effort, rests naturally as the unborn mind. You must have faith that the original mind that is realized and that which realizes original mind are not different. Resting in this way, you are a living Buddha. I think I'm done. That's about it. So Bankei was one of the most popular Japanese Zen masters. He lived from 1622 to 1693, 17th century. He was considered a Rinzai Zen master. He experienced death early in his life. You think he lost his father at 10. His father was a samurai. So he's very obsessed by death, seeing it so young and wondering what it was and what happened. He adhered, actually, in his career to no particular school of his teaching. And his teachings were said to be very immediate and raw, and that he could, like, everyone could get something from it, no matter who he spoke to. He spoke to lay, he spoke to children, he spoke to anyone, and he would always be able to, they would come away with something to be suffering a little bit less from what he said. In his 20s, so if you can imagine a 20-year-old man, he withdrew into a hut and had a really strenuous meditation practice. It was what he drove himself. It's said that he wore his buttocks raw. Literally. He couldn't even sit on it anymore. That's how much he sat to try and relieve his doubts. So he had grueling ordeals, and he got very, very sick, on the brink of hunger and starvation. That's how he drove himself. And this was all, it might have been tuberculosis, they said, but he just lay in his hut and was really, like, ill and dying. And he also later said he recognized he was working through, this was a spiritual part of him that he was working through. And he does not recommend this for all of us. That's what he left us with, is you don't have to do this, actually. Just rest. Just rest. But he, one day, he felt something in his throat. You may know this story. And he summoned up all his strength and to bring up this dark ball of phlegm. And he spit it against a wall. And at that moment, okay, it could be a plum blossom, it could be a pebble hits the bamboo, phlegm hitting the wall, the whole weight of his illness dissolved and his doubt. He realized he had the answer to his question all along. He said, the innate mind that manages everything naturally and effortlessly, just as it is, I see it. I see it. And it was totally life-changing. He saw what had never been born and saw that illuminating source he's speaking of in everything. And again, he like the Buddha, said, you don't have to go through these austerities that I did. He said, you don't have to go through this, what I did. He didn't adhere to sutras, to ceremonies. He broke from the traditional koan system. He had no heirs, except for this, right here today. Here he is speaking to us. So I love that one of my favorite frames or phrases was that all these comings and goings are just pulses in the pattern. So we're celebrating Buddha's birthday today and many of the holy days, Easter, and there's many this month. Buddha, who clearly raised the level of awareness and spiritual patterns for all of humanity, that we're even here today. And I was appreciating why we bathed the baby Buddha, and there were many things about that on the web. So once it spoke of seven kinds of blessings, lack of illnesses, purity in body and mind, constant fragrance emitted from the body, plump, soft, and delicate body, good affinities with other people, fresh, fragrant breath, naturally having clean clothes to wear as desired. So maybe it's good we all bathed the Buddha this morning. But Buddha said, and I was like, an ancestor said, those who sincerely bathe the statue of a Buddha as if the Buddha was present, that's the feeling you want to create. And it's none other than this body and mind. I had a birthday this month, and somebody sent me an email, happy unborn day. And then last week, my father, Morton Kimmel, passed away. I wanted to mention it because some of you have been writing and asking, and I appreciate all the care and the letters and the heartfelt connections with the passing of Father. So I wanted to mention and celebrate his life. Some of you met him when we showed the documentary that he was in, The Cold Blue, about his air battles in World War II. He was in the 8th Air Force, and it was made by the director, William Wyler, and his film crew that actually flew with these B-17s, and they had all this raw footage. I think Wyler and some of his film crew may have gone down. I'm not sure. I didn't check that. But I know a few of them were killed in doing this filming. But they found these films and they created this, The Cold Blue, which you can see on HBO, by the way. And my dad had it was a very defining moment for a 20-year-old young man. That's when he went in, left his home in Philadelphia. His group was called the Lucky Seven. Actually, his group made it through, and he remained in touch with all of them throughout his life. So he flew B-17s and was trained as a bombardier. It sits in that little bubble underneath And he was also trained as a second pilot. So like here, you have many positions. So if somebody is out, you can step in. So that was his second position. And he survived 36 grueling missions from 1943 to 1945. He would be coming up on his 98th birthday, born in 1923. And he's married to my mother, which is a feat in itself. I love you, Mom. 73 years. And he has raised me for 63 of them. So that's something to think about, you know, those two for 73 years. He was great in history. He could name all the 12 Supreme Court justices. I used to go to his history classes with him. And they would say, "Mort, can you just wait a moment, give someone else a chance?" Because he was just so ready to take it up. And then someone asked him why he was doing lectures, he was doing presentations on the war. And someone asked him, "Why? Why do you do this? Why do you keep talking about it?" He was very gentle and able to talk about it. Some were not, but he could. He said, "Because I never, ever, ever want any of my children or anyone else's children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren to ever have to go through what we saw. I know it's still happening," he would say, "but I don't want it to." So all these comings and goings are just pulses in the pattern being unborn. It's also undying. It's not possible for it is not unborn to perish. We never came into being and we never go out of being. I remember years back in 2006, my best friend growing up, Tracy, died of cancer. And at the funeral, people saw I was a monastic. And this group of young girls came up in a huddle and they're like, "She'll know, she'll know." And I was like, "Oh my God." And they were like, "Where is Tracy now? Where did she go?" And they were staring at me for the answer. And I was thinking of in the poem, that line that we heard this morning, "We should know each other. We should know each other." Where I answered after I was like looking at them, and I'm like, "Yeah, my God, where is she now? Where is she now?" Looking at them, "Where is she? Where do you feel her?" And it was all that I could answer at the time. And I came away with doubts, like, did I? Did I answer them? So these kind of encounters bring us right to the great matter. How do we understand the self? And I remember in practice, I remember Dido saying in several talks, in birth, some of you may remember this very well, in birth, not a single atom is added. In death, not a single particle is lost. Where do you find yourself? Who are you? This person is dead. Where did they go? That's what he would say. And that just got right under everything. What? What? So eventually, I went to Dokusan to inquire. And Dokusan, by the way, means meeting with a handshake. That was helpful. So I went in to shake hands about this. And I said, "In many of your talks, you say, At birth, not a single atom is increased, and at death, not a single atom is lost. What does this mean, Roshi? What's happening? And he took me in with his bulging, wet eyes that he had, and he said, at birth, not a single atom comes into being, and at death, not a single atom departs. Do you understand? And I could still feel the resonance of this. Like my mind just stopping, and I think I just stared. I mean, isn't that what I just asked? But it came back differently. He gave me some space, and like he usually does, when you're stunned, he says, anything else? And rings the bell. So in due course, I learned, like many of us, that when we're so affected by a teaching, that we're delivered something and we should pay attention. So if you get that, if you get that ping, that it's our way, our body's way of asking us to grow. And it comes with growing pains. We might call it bewilderment, unsure, unmoored, until it soaks in. We have to keep soaking it in, asking. And in that, we're growing. We're reaching for the light, right? Like a plant. It doesn't hold back, right? With the sun, you don't see like a few petals or leaves going like, nah. No, the whole thing just moves towards it. So you just move towards it. But I wondered, how could something like this be unborn? I'm here, right? You're there. I told you, March 20th, out I came. What was that? Who was that? What did we learn? What is it? What's Bankai referring to? He describes the unborn in glowing terms. He says, what I call the unborn is the Buddha mind. This Buddha mind is unborn with a marvelous virtue of illuminative wisdom. In the unborn, all things fall right into place and remain in perfect harmony. So what's all the clamoring and confusion? What's being born on this unborn? What are we giving birth to? And then he gives an idea of how the unborn mind functions with this. The unborn manifests itself in the thought, I want to see, I want to hear, not being born. The reason I say it's in the unborn that you see and hear is this way, because the mind doesn't give birth to any thought or inclination to see or hear. So what about it? The mind doesn't give birth to any thought or inclination to see or hear. That the unborn mind deals with the immediate sensory input before thoughts about direct experience arise. Eyes see, nose hear, nose smells, tongue tastes the salt and sour. Very simple. So, on Hosan, somebody broke out some ice cream. This is a simple sort of example. So, we eat something, especially like ice cream, and immediately have some sensation of taste. We don't have to try to taste. We just taste. And assuming that most of us, at least here, online today are developing a meditation practice. In your zazen, you might notice that a sensory input can then set off a chain of events. There is the taste, the identification of the taste. Then there's an evaluation. Yum. Or, ooh, God. Or something else. And then maybe a final stage of a little more. I'm done. No thanks. The mind just tastes without adding anything extra to the immediate experience. That's what Bankai is calling the unborn mind. So these extras, the things we add kind of like Velcro, they just come in, these thoughts. And sometimes it closes us and sometimes it opens us. And, of course, we chanted this morning the Heart Sutra, so this term Bankai uses, unborn, appears in the Heart Sutra. And the word for it is fusho, unborn, fusho, not born, not destroyed, not appear. And then when I looked in the Pali Canon, the short discourses of the Buddha, Udana, which is inspired utterances, which we remember from the Theragata, the inspired Udanas of the women ancestors. We find the Buddha speaking about the unborn. If you're interested, it's the Kudaka Nikaya. There is monastics, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unfabricated. There is. If there were not that unborn, unbecome, unmade, unfabricated, there would not be case that escape from the born, become, made, fabricated would be discerned. But precisely, and that's a good word, he says, the Buddha, precisely because there is an unborn, a vastness, an openness, an unmade, an unfabricated, escape from the born, become, made, fabricated, is discerned. So we can discern it because there's nothing to it. It's unfabricated to begin with. It wasn't born. Then we can actually discern it. We can look at it. That's what we can do. That's what awareness can do with itself. So, from the sutta, we get these great synonyms, unborn, unbecome, unmade. There's another sutra, short discourse, where the Buddha uses a number of words to describe the unconditioned. So, just so you know, you may have read it, and it's all the same, talking, it might be talking about the same thing. The uninformed, the end, the taintless, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, naturally non-distressed, nibbana, fading of lust, the beyond, the undisintegrating, the subtle, the very hard to see. So unfabricated. So what do we mean by fabrication? Putting something together, right? And I always love this story, short, about this monastic painter that lived in a cave. I think I've told it before. Many, many, many years, and they used to paint on their pictures on the cave wall. And so they started to make a painting of a tiger, really detailed. You know, all the stripes with all the hairs and whiskers, and then they were putting the finishing touches on the eye, and they stood back and they screamed and ran out of the cave. So that's what we do to ourselves. We fabricate this whole thing in our mind, and then we look at it and we just freak out. We scare ourselves in what we just painted in just these amazing details. We can do that, right? And so if we can do it in those ways, there's lots of ways we can fabricate, both some that are not so helpful and some that may actually move us into openness, right? So the Buddha is saying, because we can discern or notice the unborn or the unfabricated, we can reverse it. We can reverse the fabricated way of being in the world. Because there's the unborn, the unmade, the unfabricated. So he's pointing to our process of thinking and grasping. Second noble truth, grasping to fabrications, wandering aimlessly and endlessly in samsara, dissatisfied. Because what we concoct, we don't want, or we have to get it, or something else. So we can stop engaging in the actions that will set up this future path, the third noble truth. There is a state where all suffering ends, where we can see our mind as the universe itself. Every bit of it, every fabrication, non-dual, free of concepts. We can discern or notice what took birth, how we enter that cycle, and reverse the process. That's those 12 links that you are hearing about, interdependent origination or arising. The fundamentals, starting with ignorance, the fundamental misunderstanding of who we are that kicks it off. The cycle is rooted, so we have to pull the roots up. And Buddha shows suffering is born after a series of mental events. I like how his name is Tulka Thondrup in this book called The Heart. I drew a picture. The Heart of Unconditional Love. I'm like, what's that? Yeah, I drew it. And this, I'll just be brief. I'm not going to go into it deeply, but I like how he says, what are the 12 links of interdependent arising? Because of ignorance, formation, or karma arises. Because of formation, karma, consciousness arises. Because of consciousness, the mental components and body arise. Because of mental components and body, the six sense bases arise. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. Because of contact, feeling arises. Because of feeling, craving arises. Because of craving, clinging arises. Because of clinging, becoming arises. Because of becoming, birth takes place. Because of birth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentations, suffering, sadness, and conflicts take place. The Buddha meditated on the reversal that brings the chain of the 12 links to an end. He said, the cessation of ignorance causes the cessation of formation. The stopping of birth causes the stopping of old age, sickness, and death, like we chanted, old age and death. Like, but I'm going to get old. So how can we say that? No old age. So it's gone right to that in the Heart Sutra. And the whole great heap of suffering, cessation. Through this meditation, the Buddha realized that there is no self as a truly existing reality, but just the emptiness or openness nature where all arises and ceases through mere dependence on causes and conditions, like a mirage. The Buddha said, those bodhisattvas who obtain the wisdom of realizing the union of interdependent arising and the unborn and unceasing nature of emptiness, like rays of the unclouded sun dispelling darkness, destroy ignorance, and attain naturally present Buddhahood. So if we do not want to suffer, prevent it from being born as a mental state. Is not born again into this world. Don't keep it all going. So whatever those things are, those proliferations, it's actually none of our business. Just let it, don't make it your business. Just let it come and just like make your business like ceasing. Like don't proliferate it. Don't keep the whole thing going. Notice and release. Do we end the world as we know it? There's death in that moment. Death of that idea, that progression, that suffering. So Buddha said, lacking inherent existence, the self is no self as a truly existing reality. I told you Edward Kant would say, looks like a lot, but it's actually nothing. And this is the energy of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. How can they look upon the suffering? How can we, don't make it out too far out, look upon the suffering of the world with compassion? They look upon with no roots. And it's these no roots that keep us from being usurped or overwhelmed. Dogen has that great line in Being Time where he says, overwhelm overwhelms overwhelming. That sort of, to me, brings it back to that openness. Like, overwhelm, overwhelms. What kind of line is that? Overwhelm, overwhelms, overwhelming. And then we can see the many forms and hear it, the suffering, the cries, because there's so much of it that needs to be attended to and cared for. So we can think of unborn dharmas, moments of experience, are empty dharmas, is what he's saying. Empty of inherent existence, own nature, self-nature. The sutras don't say unborn phenomena doesn't exist at all, but they don't exist inherently. Bankai says, unborn mind is the dependently arising mind of the moment, which is created by moments of dependently arising sensory input. So here from the faith mind, maybe this passage I thought gave me another perspective of the experience of the unborn mind. When discriminating thoughts do not arise, the usual mind ceases to exist. When thought objects vanish, the thinking subject vanishes. When the mind vanishes, objects vanish. Object is object because of subject. Subject is subject because of the object. The usual mind, when we say the usual mind, is what Bankai called the born mind, the product of discriminating thoughts. We give birth to, as I said, our mental formations and grasp, that we grasp. As Bankai put it, your self-partiality is at the root of all your illusions because there isn't one as we may have known it. And in that usual mind, this discriminating mind seems very real and solid. And then we close into our little boxes and others into theirs. You know, back to the ice cream. You know, we might just take a bite and then suddenly we're on like, you know, you really shouldn't eat ice cream because it comes from cows and they're just destroying everything, you know. We just take it away. I remember Vimala Sara said, she did a TED talk on our stinking thinking. She said, you have to stop grasping your stinking thinking and cultivate loving compassion. I think it was a few talks ago, Roshi spoke about how the untrained mind grasps, kind of as I remember it, at subjects and objects as a way of trying to be okay or trying to avoid pain or uncertainty. That's immediately where we go to get some ground, to be okay, to try to be okay and avoid pain or uncertainty. And then what we can realize is that we're still okay if we don't grasp it. We're still okay. The moment we grasp or wish something to be different from the way it is, heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So we recognize, allow, let go. That's that reversal. So when our mind wanders off in zazen, we become aware that we've drifted off and we decide to return to our intended practice, and then we return to our intended practice and we make an immediate pathway to here. Now, whether we stay or we take flight is what we're learning. Because, you know, our attention span is pretty short sometimes, right? It's like we land and then take off again and then come back to the branch. But we're already in the great ocean. That's the Buddha mind, all of it. We just have these waves, as it's sometimes described. But it's all the ocean, every bit of it. And I was thinking of patience paramita, patience, usually translated as patience or tolerance or forbearance, how much that's needed. And then I looked it up again, and it said the Sanskrit term is anuttapitaka dharma kasanti, which means having the patient acceptance for the unborn, the non-origination of all dharmas. So we have the patience. We have to have the patience to see, to allow that to happen, right? It takes some patience because we so don't. That's not what we learned. Like we're intolerant and impatient, almost non-accepting that we're non-dual. We just have to split. What is faith is what we're working with. What is trust? So in these intolerable moments, we might meet faith in the most intolerable moments. That's where the art practice is calling us, to those changing forms of faith. As Bankai put it, your self-partiality is at the root of all your illusions. Your self-partiality is at the root of all your delusions. So I started hearing roots a lot. Roots. In the four immeasurables, may we be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May we know happiness and the root of happiness. Root and branch must return to the great reality. Most of us have been in the garden pulling up roots. And you know there's a way to pull up roots. Now there's some that are rooted, and some that have no roots. They're beginning and endless. And I remembered reading in D.T. Suzuki's book, there's a part where someone meets him and asks, after you're enlightened, do you suffer anymore? And this is D.T. Suzuki. He says, oh, yes. Oh, yes, you do. And he says, well, have you suffered? And D.T. Suzuki said, yes, yes, when my wife died, I cried bitter, bitter tears. And the person said, well, what's the point of practice? And D.T. Suzuki said, oh, my tears had no roots. My tears have no roots. So I've been looking at that because I've been crying a lot. And it has different flavors. Tears have so many flavors. And I can tell where there's roots that have a beginning and an end, and some that are just immediate and open, and they're just tears. And I can, the next moment, I may be laughing hysterically. Or looking at the blue sky or beauty. How does that happen that we can be one moment just weeping that we lost someone, and the next moment someone says something and it's just hysterical? That's freedom. That's freedom. But sometimes there's roots. I would just say, I personally am very respectful of my tears. Every one of them is a release from either the grasping, from not either, but just they release. They release some grasping. And sometimes they're just, it's just crying. Just crying. Do we cling to some root or some truth about our tears, or are they just tears? Without stories, without blame. They're just tears. So to just pause and look and come into attunement with your tears. Daito Roshi said his words, we need to understand rootlessness itself. Rootless means the roots are gone. They're either cut off or undeveloped. When used in terms of people, rootless means that they've no close ties, no connections. Well, what kind of thing has no connections to anything? Is that what Dharma is about? He goes on, all dharmas are nothing but rootless. They're not connected to anything, but contain everything. There's the difference right there. My tears have no roots. All dharmas are nothing but rootless. They're not connected to anything, but contain everything. Do you understand? Do you understand? Dido says, not in your head, because it's easy enough to understand intellectually, but do you understand in your body? That being the case, where do all these boundaries come from? Where do I end and you begin? What creates these edges? It's got to do with your mind and how you use it, how you see yourself, and how you see the universe. Give life to the unborn mind, a living Buddha. And I'll just end with a poem by Bankei himself. Clinging, craving, and the like. I don't have them on my mind. That's why nowadays I can say the whole world is truly mine. Indeed. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.